Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. It may interest you to know. I'm Tony Marcolini. I'm joined today with a fascinating panel. Let me introduce first my co-host, my guest co-host for today, former retired judge Bradley Ferenz. Welcome, Judge Ferenz.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also, David Slater, photographer and author, and you probably know him as the monkey selfie guy, but it's a fascinating case we're going to get into today. And his attorney, Andrew Dewey, who I think did a brilliant job handling his case. So welcome, David and Andrew.
Thank you.
So I chased you to get you on the podcast because I'm fascinated by this case. Not just the legal arguments, because I think that, you know, it's a dialogue I want to open up and get into. But you're a photographer, David. You were very mm-hmm. much into wildlife. Mm-hmm. And there comes a point in time in 2008 that you go to Indonesia to take photographs. And I'm going to turn it over to you. I actually want to hear this story of what you observed and what happened in your own words.
Okay. Well, maybe I should start by just saying that the date of which the photograph was taken is unknown, and I'm not going to say anything because it's a point of contention. You've taken that from Wikipedia.
And several other sources report it that way. So, yeah, correct. Yeah.
Well, it was originally 2011, and that's when the story broke. So we'll start from 2011. So that was after I traveled to Sulawesi in Indonesia on a conservation trip where I wanted to photograph many of the monkeys there. They have seven species of monkeys in Sulawesi, and their territory sort of overlap like a jigsaw. It's all very interesting. And I've been there before in the south of Sulawesi to photograph the Bhutan and the booted macaques. And I took the opportunity this time, after some more research, to go to the very northern tip of Sulawesi, where it's on the equator, to photograph what I thought was one of the most charismatic monkeys I've ever seen. But I'd only seen them in a photograph. So I took myself out there at great expense, and I traveled around the island because you land in the south of the island. I did a little bit of tourist stuff there. Then I tried to photograph as much wildlife in the middle section of Sulawesi before I caught a plane to the north. And I spent only 3 days in this national park, Tankoko National Park. And I had to find a guide before I set out trying to find what I thought would be an excessively rare and hard to find monkey. So after all this trip, after all this travel, very hot, humid, very tiring, I eventually landed outside the park gates. I couldn't go in unless I had a guide. So where I was staying, I discovered a local guide who then took me in, and he spoke no English.
Oh.
So that was a bad start to me anyway. So he just led me by the hand into the park on the first day, and we probably walked in the intense heat. It was like 35 degrees in the shade, 40 odd degrees in the sun, and I have got a massive backpack on, like 20 kilograms. And we walked for hours and hours and hours and only got glimpses of the macaques, but at least I knew they were there. So I spent the night in a local hostel. We came back to the out of the park, spent the night in a local hostel, very basic, not speaking because he couldn't speak. Really eventually went home. So the very next day, about 6 o'clock, we went out, and immediately we found a troop of monkeys right outside the park gates, which was amazing. And they were so tiny. I imagine they were going to be like chimpanzees, but they weren't. They're only like the size of a cat or a small dog. And I decided that I wanted to follow these monkeys and try and get pictures as I went along, which proved a lot more difficult than I was expecting, mainly because of the heat, the tiredness, the light in the rainforest, and just the fact that they didn't really sit still and they just kept walking. So we started to walk after them and shadowing them, which got us really tired because we had to climb over rough ground. There was no paths for most of it. And it was exhausting, and it was good that every now and again, they'd sit down and have a rest, and they'd start grooming each other. And I decided that's what I would do. I knew a lot about monkey etiquette, and I wanted to act like they do. So over a few hours, they'd move and I'd move and I'd sit down with them. And that's when I got my opportunity to start taking photographs, because at least they were stopped then. And the light level was such that I could take take the photograph. If they were moving, the light level was too low and they'd be blurred. But eventually, by about midday, in the heat of the day, they took about the fourth rest that morning, and I sat down as usual, and I ate some biscuits, and they all ate fleas and things in the back of them. And eventually, probably after them hearing the shutter clicking for a few times, some of them came over to investigate me. And amazingly, they started to sit next to me, and some would sit behind me, and more had come all the time. So I thought, this is brilliant. It was a fantastic experience, and I thought, I want to take a photograph of this.
Were you afraid?
No. I've been around monkeys before. I've often been bitten, and eventually they did start biting me a little bit, just playful nibbles, but not scared at all. And I think they probably picked up on that. So after a few goals, actually, of trying to put my camera, this camera, with a short lens on it, right in their faces, they didn't like it. If I did this, it was too close. It's a wide angle lens, so I had to be literally sort of, you know, a meter away to get a good photograph. And they weren't having it. They showed their teeth and they run away. And the more that happened, the more I thought that I wanted to get that full frame wide angle image. And it was stuck in my head from that very first day, actually. But this moment during the mid second day, I thought, at least I'll try and get a photograph of them sitting around me. So I set my camera up on a log with a bean bag, so just resting on the log, and I put a self timer on, and they'd started to sit next to me. I got up, turned the timer on, then run back and tried to sit with them. So they were around me like a family, and then the shutter would go off. And of course, that didn't work for a while. I had to keep getting up, resetting it, running back. And eventually, on the last go, I was exhausted. My sweating was everywhere. My T-shirt was soaked. On the last go, I thought, in my head, this has to work now. I sat down and I went like that. And the monkey put its hand on my hand and the camera went off.
Wow. Next,
this is one of the pictures that did the rounds in the newspapers of me holding the hands of the monkey. Soon after that photograph was taken, another monkey turned up and walked along this log and grabbed the camera. Right? This is the stealing of the camera bit that we might come on to later. And he tried to run off with it, to which I scrambled to grab the camera, missed him, and I shouted for my guide, who was just out of view. He was having a cigarette. And I said, come back, or something like that. He heard me and he came into view and he got the camera off this monkey. And he tried to get the camera off the monkey, and it was resisting. And it started, maybe by accident or maybe by design, it clicked the buttons and the camera started firing off. Right? So we got the camera back. We looked at the pictures and they were all of the forest floor, blurred trees, whatever. There was nothing on there that was useful, and I just deleted them all. I'm very good at deleting. It's one of my things. I just delete as I go along. But the fact that it had grabbed the camera and been fascinated with the shutter noise, I thought, this is my chance to get them looking in here. But I couldn't do this. I had to set the camera up on a tripod. So maybe an hour later, after this stealing of the camera, I set this up on a tripod with a cable release and some bait, which happened to be like chocolate biscuits that I put on the floor. So they come in. They were a little bit nervous to begin with. So I had to move backwards away and let this tripod just stand it on the forest floor with this cable release, where the monkeys started to come and play with it. And of course, there's a bit of a danger that they'd knock it over. But I kept thinking, they need to get hold of this cable release, because there's a button on it that they only needed to press or put in their mouth or something, and it would click. And that would get them excited again. And lo and behold, after, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, one of them actually pressed the button and the camera started clicking. It was on a motor wind. I had to jump for the camera tripod. I laid on the floor and held the tripod because I was worried about it pulling the cable release and breaking the camera, pulling the tripod over. So I'm lying on the floor and it's clicking the buttons.
So you're right there. I mean, you didn't
right there in the truth.
Walk away to, you know, someplace.
No, I just stood back about 5 meters.
Okay.
Just
okay.
to allow them the courage to come to the camera.
Right. Okay.
But once they started to come to the camera, I crawled closer and closer till eventually, when they started getting hold of the cable release, I was lying on the floor, holding the tripod leg. And then next thing I hear is the camera shooting off on a motor wind. And I'm looking up through the tripod legs at this monkey just pulling all these faces with the shutter going off. Yeah. And that was like 10 seconds, maybe. And the noise of the shutter, the motor wind is like a chimping noise. See? So I think that chimping noise from the shutter going off made them look at the camera straight down the lens. I think they could see their own reflection in this lens. You just stick something, they can see it through there. And that made them pull all these funny faces because I think they were aware of their own reflection. They weren't aggressive, they just started pulling silly faces. I'm lying there on my stomach.
Just so I'm clear, the faces they're making now are unique from their I mean, they're actually intentionally making faces, yes?
Yeah, it was like a lady putting lipstick on in the mirror, or a man shaving, doing all these funny facial expressions, like howling, but no sound came out. And of course, they were grinning and putting the tongue out and all sorts of things. So at this moment, I'm getting bitten by things on the forest floor, and all the leaves are sticking to me because I'm sweating. There's at least 3 juveniles on my back started to bite me, and eventually, or very quickly after that, a male, the alpha male, came storming out of the undergrowth from some direction, and it absolutely jumped on my back and whacked me. Though to say, stay away from the lady in front. It's my lady. And he whacked me so hard, I said, I'm out of here, right? That was the point where I knew I had to stop all of this. So I just got up, got the camera. They all fled. And then I saw the images on the back, and I just couldn't believe that they'd taken their own picture. Although I shouldn't say taken their own picture now, because people take that as whoever takes the picture gets copyright. But in an everyday sense meaning of taking a picture, they were pressing the button. And that was it. That was it. Like 30 minutes and it's all over with.
Just a small point of information for those folks who are here in the United States. 40 degrees Celsius, so you're looking at well over 100 degrees in terms of Fahrenheit. It is a hot, no doubt humid time.
We should also note that no monkey was ever prosecuted for stealing David's camera because it's the law of the jungle there. You know, it's chaos.
Yeah, so I want to emphasize early on that the stealing of the camera was an event that gave me the idea to set the camera on a tripod. So I engineered all of that.
Wow. Endured quite a bit to get the photograph. And was there more than
one? I was exhausted.
Monkey? Yeah. Was there more than one monkey in the photograph?
Yeah, there was 20, 30 of them in this troop eventually. It was hard to count because they were all scattered. But I'd say about 20, 25, maybe 30 at the most.
And how many actually took their own picture?
Well, there was 2 that ended up good images, 2 monkeys, one the female, in my mind. I always thought it was a female, and that's why the male came and slapped me on the back, and the other was a male. But during that event, there were many monkeys trying to play with the cable release, touching the camera,
that
you don't see in the image. They're all behind.
Now, afterwards, there comes a point in time where you go forward with publicizing the images. And from that comes a lawsuit, ultimately, from PETA, I guess, suing you on behalf of the main monkey. I don't even know how else to say that, saying that the monkey technically owned the copyright in the photographs, because at least here in the United States, he or she who creates owns the copyright, right? If you write a book or you take a photograph or you sculpt something, you are the creator, therefore the copyright owner in your creation. So their legal argument was the monkey created the photo by clicking the button and therefore was the rightful owner. that's the whole basis of the lawsuit. So there comes a point in time when you are confronted with this lawsuit of PETA representing a monkey or trying to represent the monkey. And then you go to Andrew, I assume, for representation. So Andrew, David comes in about this lawsuit. What are your thoughts?
Well, I knew I'd have to do some pretty basic research because, as I would imagine, the two of you never had any coverage of animal rights in law school. I didn't, so I had to look into it. And one of the first things I saw was right here where we are, and the case was in the Ninth Circuit. There was a case, well, actually two cases that dealt with the issue. One involved butterflies, and then the one that really mattered in our case involved cetaceans, whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals. And so the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit had this case where U.S. Navy ships were harming cetaceans. And a lawyer in Hawaii said, you know, I'm going to go into federal court in Hawaii and put a stop to this. And so the Ninth Circuit had to confront a very basic question. Is that possible? And ultimately, what the Ninth Circuit said is, well, there's really nothing in the Constitution that prevents it. But we're looking now at the four statutes, the acts of Congress here, and they don't allow for animal standing. So unless Congress says something to the effect that animals can do this, we're not going to be taking that first step. So it was really interesting. The court, as I said, didn't rule out the idea of animals having standing in copyright or anything else. It's just that the court said, we're going to turn it to Congress to say that explicitly. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. So I felt pretty good with that case supporting us that we were likely to prevail, even though the argument that an animal had standing to sue in federal court had legs, so to speak, as far as the Ninth Circuit was concerned, at least.
You know, Andrew, the idea that an animal has standing is one thing. The idea that an animal has retained a person or an organization to represent an individual, not the species, so to speak, seems to be something entirely different. How did PETA get standing to represent, I mean, the animal? There was clearly no retainer. There was no agreement. There was no nexus. As far as I think I remember David saying that PETA had never met the animal, and in fact may have in fact got the animal who was photographed wrong.
Well, I don't think the lack of payment or lack of agreement was a problem for them, because that's true of a lot of situations involving incapacitated individuals and things. So, but I think that the connection did prove to be a problem in the case. It was a secondary problem. The main problem was the Copyright Act never says anything about animals having standing. Mm-hmm. And that was also a problem, is that they had some difficulty with their connection to it. But I don't know that in the end that was so important here. I think it was more the Copyright Act was the bigger concern for the judges at the Ninth Circuit and for Judge Orrick at the district court.
Well, you know what I find to be an interesting issue here is, having listened to David now talk about what he endured to take this photograph, it's clear to me that engineering the photograph was the true creation, right? Allowing the monkeys to acclimate to him slowly, allowing them to, see that the camera wasn't going to be harmful to them, setting it up in the way that he did, lying on the floor to get, knowing where to put the cable and to put some biscuits out, even, I think he said. So all of that seems to be part, to me anyway, listening, of the creative process. Mm-hmm. It's not so much like the monkey found a mound of clay and made a sculpture on its own one day in the jungle, and you came and took the sculpture and sold it as your own, where maybe I could see more of an argument that, well, I mean, like it or not, it's alive, it's a living creature that created this other item. This is really the product of what was absolutely engineered by David, short of them clicking the button, which, if you see the photographs, which I have looked at as many as I could see online or that were available online, the monkeys almost do seem like they're posing, right? And I guess it's what David said. They were fascinated by their own reflection. And they're smiling and making faces, probably enjoying seeing that reflection or maybe having never seen their own reflection. I don't know.
Well, along those lines, there's actually an old, early days of photography case where a photographer in a studio had set things up very elaborately, and but had a way for the model in the photo to essentially press the button remotely. I can't remember what the mechanism was, but then the model made that claim that, you know, I'm the one who took the photograph, and the photographer ended up winning. I can't remember the name of the case offhand, but we never got that far in the case because of the standing problems. But I do remember seeing that case, because that gets to what you're talking about. Is it, who is really the creator here? Is it the one pressing the button, or is it the one who created the environment, had all the settings on the camera, things like that? That, I mean, if the case had proceeded, we would have gotten into that, but we never got that far.
Well, I think even creating a photograph, that's the reason they say that you get the copyright, because you do engineer the angle, the exact moment, you know, you're going to take it, the angle, the lighting. I mean, all of that is part of a decision-making process to capture that particular image. But so it's clear to me that the monkey didn't have all of that involved in the decision-making process, but rather David did. But I guess the argument from PETA's sake was, you know, that on the flip side, technically selecting that moment in time has to be credited to the monkey.
See, you use the word selected. I have trouble with that word. There are blinds set up by photographers, and, you know, all the time, in which an animal walks by and at night and the photograph is taken. The animal didn't select, you know, when the photograph would go off. Walk by. Here the animals were taking photographs, many of which, David, I assume, were unusable.
Yes, they were. But I'd like to add a few things to what we've said already. It was very perplexing that, first of all, it wasn't PETA. It was Wikipedia that started this off in 2011.
Oh, tell us.
It was Wikipedia, or editors, under pseudonyms, that were making the claim that whoever presses the button gets the copyright. And so from 2011 up to the PETA case in 2014, 3 years, I had solely me battling for Wikipedia to take it off their public domain website, their Creative Commons website. What was perplexing to me is that what we've just talked about, the arranging of the scene, is certainly in Britain laid down explicitly in copyright law. It's whoever makes that arrangement is the copyright holder. It makes no difference who presses the button. But I think it's because Wikipedia, in their biased way that they are, they were trying to make a stance for all photographs on the internet, this is my belief, to all be free at one stage in the future, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and many other organizations want to destroy copyright. And Wikipedia, I think, had this biased notion that they were going to take a famous photograph and make a stunt out of it and actually degrade the meaning of copyright. So they were going against what I understood to be copyright, and they willfully ignored any of my arguments to say that I arranged it. And I think what that came from the original press releases. So when I gave my photographs to a press agent and they said this is a good story, they got it in the English tabloids to begin with on the 4th of July 2011, the story was condensed by journalists to confuse the first issue of the monkey taking the camera and clicking the button to the one where it was set up on a tripod. And this journalistic shortening of the story to make it more funny ended up with Wikipedia taking it as a literal truth that the monkey stole the camera. I had some papers like The Sun and The Mirror having it running off on its own into the yonder, and I'd lost all sight of the camera, and somehow I came across the camera later and found the photographs on the back. You know, in the early days, I thought that was funny, because some of these tabloids made a good story even better. But Wikipedia were a biased on this, and they used that story literally to make people think that the monkey had autonomous control over the camera, and it somehow got the camera, turned it on itself, and started clicking the button. Now, I think when you have a camera like this, that's really hard to understand. But I think people these days, they think it's all phones.
Like a selfie.
It'd be very easy for a monkey to do that with a phone, but not with one of these. But Wikipedia were going to stick to the story that whoever presses the button gets copyright. They were, in effect, this truth website was telling lies about what copyright is. And that gave a whole host of problems to me. That least of which, no newspaper would correct the story that originally came out. Some came close. And what really makes it amusing to me is that Wikipedia base nearly everything these days on their reputable sources, which basically means newspapers. So they're taking the Daily Mail as a de facto source of truth. But yet, Wikipedia, maybe a year or two before, had claimed that the Daily Mail was not an authoritative newspaper and you should never trust it. But when you understand how the press works, it's too late, because as soon as it gets in one paper, it gets pushed to all others. The journalists don't care to interview me. They just print it. Some of them will rewrite it, like I just said, like the camera was stolen. And very few journalists actually phone me up and actually interview me for my facts. On top of which, I wrote the story on my website. And I kept pointing Wikipedia to the story on my website. And I thought they'd use my website as an authoritative source. Not the case. They can't take my story on face value. So they just relied on third, fourth, fifth hand newspapers rehashing this story of a monkey stealing the camera and pressing the button. And I couldn't get them to change their minds.
So that's where the origin is. So you're involved in this battle with them long before PETA gets involved.
Yeah, 3 years. Yeah.
Wow.
And they refused to remove it off this public domain or Creative Commons website, where they were telling the world that because the monkey pressed the button, this image was free to anybody to use in any way they liked, thus denying me of any royalties on it.
I wonder how much of that was just Wikipedia wanting to have control and dominion over that photograph and the story. Yeah, because absolutely. If in fact you remained in control of it, they couldn't print it. So it was in a sense a self-serving denial and refusal to hear the other side and do any kind of significant research. Right. It's hardly research, I would think, to read newspaper accounts that are based on other newspaper accounts that are based on what they heard at Fox News, so to speak.
That's right. I think Wikipedia just has a strong incentive to get everything into the public domain one way or the other. I mean, I don't think they were so much invested in whether the monkey owned the copyright, so to speak, and because Congress doesn't let monkeys own copyright, then it's public domain. The key is the getting to public domain.
I agree with you. That's the whole process, and that's exactly what they're interested in, everything.
So Wikipedia's argument really is in conflict with PETA's argument. PETA's saying there is a copyright owner, it's just the monkey.
No, Wikipedia says there is no owner.
Right, Wikipedia is, no, there's no owner, it's public domain. PETA's saying it's the monkey.
Right.
So now there's a lot of hands chasing this photograph. And you have your legal position with Andrew that, you know, I'm the rightful owner, I engineered this creation.
Right. You know, it's an interesting self-serving argument, kind of bootstrapping, saying, of course it's in the public domain, and not recognizing we put it in the public domain.
Yeah, they did.
So when Andrew and you first sit down with Andrew and he's going through, I guess, what the legal arguments are with you, because we can all agree that Andrew did a brilliant job representing.
I think we can agree on that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah all right.
Well, I had a lot of attorneys chasing me for this case, maybe a dozen or so, all wanting huge amounts of money from me, and trying to make this case sound very complicated. And then Andrew turns up, offering his help. And then I looked at his Facebook site, and immediately loved the way that he dressed in a tuxedo and this, that, and the other.
Technically a Chippendales outfit.
And so we had a chat and we had a little bit of a laugh about that and saying that I like people, eccentric people. I'd rather go with Andrew. But he was the only one that put me at ease. about how simple that this case should be, because monkeys don't have standing, and he was quite happy to take it on, weren't you, Andrew? As though it would be over with very quickly.
Well, I did think that they had quite a challenge in getting around the cetacean community case. It might have been different in another circuit. There might have been a little more to it, but I had trouble imagining a way around that case. And the way it works is the Judge Orrick had to follow cetacean community, as did the three initial judges at the Ninth Circuit. So I just thought that would just, I'm more of an appellate type. And so when you have binding precedent like that, it's really hard to get around it. And that's how it played out.
And just for anyone who doesn't have a background in the law, this in federal court, it's kind of like the law of the circuit, right? If a case happens in your circuit, it's binding on any other case that comes up in the circuit.
Exactly. And any of the other 12 or the other 11 regional circuits, Peter could have said, well, we don't think you should follow cetacean community. That's a bad decision. You can ignore it. And that would be true. But in the Ninth Circuit, neither the trial judge nor the initial three judges have that option. They have to follow it. So that this was probably the worst circuit for them to be in for this case.
Yeah, agreed. So you're left in the position now, in what I consider to be, I guess, a relatively good position that it was in that circuit, because otherwise the argument would have been it's only persuasive authority. Judge, exactly. you can go by it or not go by it. You know, right. It's up to you. We say no. Whereas they were put in that very unique position of saying, I have to stay consistent to this ruling that's already out there.
Right, but the publisher was based in San Francisco, so I don't know that Peter really had any other venue options. If they were going to do anything, they would have to be in the Ninth Circuit.
And now, David, there comes a point in time when you write a book about the experience and publish a lot of photographs. I think it's called Wildlife Personalities.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? So talk to me about the book and creating that.
It was during the time when I was having problems with Wikipedia and trying to get my story out. So I thought, why not combine it in a book? And at the same time, I would cover my own sort of philosophical thoughts of why I do wildlife photography and why I go out there so much. So it was in 2014, and I particularly put the monkey on the cover. I've got it here now.
I put it
on the cover.
I've got that in my living room.
Yeah. Well, actually, the monkey here is not the monkey that everybody knows. It's one of the sequins that the monkey took, but this has never been put on the internet. Wikipedia will steal this.
That's a completely different monkey, and both.
No, this is the same monkey, but it's part of a sequence of the motorwine. Okay. So I've got about three or four of them. Mm-hmm. So that's provocative, because Wikipedia can't get hold of that because it's hard copy. And I put inside copyright myself to sort of try and push the idea that I am claiming copyright.
And had you registered? Had you registered the photographs as well with copyright?
I had in 2011 when I first discovered Wikipedia was doing this to me. I asked Wikipedia to take it down. And they did. And during that moment or that week or two where they took it down, I registered the image, everything on my website that included this image, with the US Copyright Office. And they accepted it. But later on, there was arguments that was done null and void, simply because I hadn't notified the Copyright Office that the monkey pressed the button. So I was already being told by people in the Copyright Office that it's not an easy case because I somehow withheld information from that registration.
Wow. So in other words, they expected you to fill out the form like it was too, like you and the monkey created it?
Well, I didn't know because they'd have been taken off Wikipedia. I didn't think it was an issue. I thought, lesson learned, I need to register everything I have with the Copyright Office because hopefully that helps with attorney fees and stuff, I understand. So it was registered, but I wrote the book, a little bit of a wind up, but also a way to get out my philosophy on how I view animals to be just like us, in a new way to get people to appreciate wildlife more and not seeing animals as different to us, but seeing them as different personalities, if you will. So I used all the psychological distinctions, like they've got five categories of personality traits for humans, such as openness, neurotic, there's five of them, conscientiousness, extrovert, and I can't remember the other one now, but I thought I could show people that animals are exactly the same. They have these different personality traits. And I thought that was a nice way just to introduce to hopefully a wider public that animals shouldn't be seen as distinct from us, that they're part of our consciousness in a way. So that got published in 2014.
And it's available now, right, for purchase.
It is available, but yeah. I'm not sure. It was on Blurb and Amazon, but they charge too much. But I think it's the moment that got published, somehow PETA got to see it and they took the opportunity to take issue with the copyright infringement side of the story, because I had now published an image that this monkey that they call Naruto had taken. So I was infringing on its copyright now just because of the publication of this book.
And that's when PETA became involved.
That's it. That was the thing they must have been waiting for.
They wanted their client to have his or her fair share.
Yeah, because without publication, there wouldn't be any basis for a lawsuit. So yeah, the publication would be the alleged copying of the claimed copyright of the mm-hmm. monkey.
So at the point that you are enthralled in the middle of this lawsuit, I don't remember. I've read the initial documents. I don't remember seeing Wikipedia involved. They didn't get involved in the litigation. Am I correct?
No, yeah. They just stayed out of it. They just, even to this day as we speak, they're still pushing that this is a free photograph for people to use. They won't listen to any, you know, they've covered the PETA story. But they haven't changed their minds. They're quite happy now. Wikipedia are quite happy because they feel that they've won, because now they know that the monkey can't own copyright, because that's now been declared in a court. So Wikipedia are just sticking to it. And it seems that I've got to take them to court and prove that I'm the copyright owner, even though copyright law clearly states that I am. But Wikipedia won't listen to my version. They won't listen to the press's version.
Tony, going back to what you were saying, actually, so Wiki was at odds with PETA. So if PETA had prevailed, the Wiki would have had a problem with PETA, because then there would have been another claim against Wiki.
So. Right, the monkey could have sued Wikipedia.
That would have been case number two.
I did ask that question at some stage.
That monkey would have just kept going in the court system. Wow.
That monkey would have owned Wikipedia.
Now, how interesting would that have been? So after you publish the book, PETA at that point sees sees that there's value to owning the photograph along with your publication. They pursue you. And there comes a point in time where, I don't think I'm talking, I'm revealing any secrets here, but there becomes a point in time when there is an opinion registered by a judge in the circuit where you have the case, indicating in the that judge's opinion, consistent with what Andrew was saying, an animal couldn't own the copyright. Did I get that right?
That's right.
There were two opinions, the district judge, Judge Orrick, and then another opinion from the Ninth Circuit judges, yes.
Okay, so then that's at the point that the litigation somewhat stops. You never make it all the way up, let's say, to the Supreme Court, but the last of the opinions out there was that the animal, could not own a copyright.
Right, the Ninth Circuit precedential decision was the last decision in the case.
I mean, obviously, I know that you guys feel that that was the right decision. Well, Andrew, this question's really for you. What was it like at that point arguing that case? What was the vibe in the courtroom with you and the attorney for PETA?
Well, it was pretty clear very early in the oral argument that the Ninth Circuit judges were sympathetic to our side. And that that became clear before I ever set foot at the podium, because my opposing counsel was just getting harangued by all three judges. It just really looked favorable before I ever said a word. So I almost had some sympathy for my friend on the other side, just because I've been there. When I'll bet the two of you have in practice too, and maybe judge, you've had a very skeptical attitude towards litigants. Yeah, it's no fun at all to be up at that podium when you know you've lost, and it's only going to be a question of how badly you're going to lose. And that became pretty clear early in the oral argument.
Was yes. there any possibility that the judge could have assigned counsel fees to PETA for bringing a suit that...
We won fees.
You did?
The Copyright Act, it's not a guarantee that you win fees if you win, but the judges have discretion to award fees. We asked for a fee award, and we were awarded fees.
Good.
Now, it's my understanding, David, that at this point in time, there is a film in the making to tell your story. Am I correct?
Yeah. I was contacted shortly after the lawsuit finished by a producer called Jeremy Steckler, wanting to see if he could buy the rights to my story. At the time, I was having lots of other offers for other film producers and theatre productions and many, many other things and books. But eventually, Jeremy talked me into it, that it would be on the big screen. It wouldn't be a documentary, it would be a film, he advised that this was going to be big, and I needed to get an agent and lawyers to look over various contracts, which I did, and signed those probably in 2019. All going well, and then COVID hit.
Yeah.
And I think I was expecting it to have been done and released by now, but it's still in development. And I've still got my fingers crossed.
The main question is, will Brad Pitt play me? That's my hope, but he might be busy with other projects.
I don't know. I think Brad Pitt would make a good you, Andrew.
I think he'd look at the he'd look good in the Chippendale outfit also.
Absolutely.
Of all the bases covered, yeah. Now the film, I assume, I mean, the big moment is the moment the photographs were taken, and certainly what you orchestrated. I imagine having to recreate that in a film is not going to be easy.
They've interviewed me quite at length about the technicalities of how it happened. So, like, I started with this, the date of which I took the photograph up fully will be revealed in the film, and all the details that I've talked about how I took it will be recreated somehow. I don't know how. But other than that, I don't really know what else they have in mind. It's a work in progress. I've been told that they're looking it to be on the comedy side of the story to make it amusing. So I'm looking forward to it immensely. It's very frustrating though, because of the last 2.5 years have been a bit of a no event for things.
Not much of a comedy over the last couple of years, huh?
No, and I've been really worried that the film industry has been badly affected. California, where they all live, has had very tight lockdowns. And I don't know the situation.
And there's no word on who's going to play the monkey.
Well, these guys have been involved in Pixar animations before.
Well, I mean, it's going to be very hard to get the monkeys to exactly do what the prior monkeys did. I mean, I would think all their best efforts. It'll be interesting to see how those scenes turn out.
I'm so looking forward to it, because it could be very good. And I already have music lined up for them. The Dance Monkey music track, have you heard that? That just so reminds me of those 30 minutes to an hour with the monkeys, where they basically danced with me.
That's incredible.
Good way of putting it, you know? Yeah. It creates an image in your head when you think about the monkeys dancing with you. Yeah. So
do you
think you'll have the opportunity to look at the script before they actually go into production?
I do hope so. It's in the contract, so I do hope so, and I will have a little bit of say so. I'm not expecting them to make it absolutely factual. You know, I think they'll exaggerate as they do.
Based upon what you're telling us, I don't think they have to stray very far from the truth.
Yeah, right.
Very entertaining and comedic film.
Yeah. No. Well, just fingers crossed, and hopefully they'll have something good news for me very soon.
Well, it's an incredible story. Can you talk to me a little bit about NFTs?
Right, so we were discussing this earlier. That's another thing that is new to me, but it's something that I'm working towards now. I have my news agent that first broke this story in 2011, being full in the news and in images. They are now encouraged by my belief in this NFT story of where collectors are quite good at wanting to buy the original image, and it's a digital image that goes on the blockchain, a bit like what Bitcoin does, and people will go to auction and buy images over the blockchain. And my agent thinks that this would be a very good NFT for collectors to buy, and it's a subject I don't know too much about. And it's probably a bubble that some of these images are going for many, many thousands of dollars.
Some are going for a lot more than thousands of dollars.
I think so as well. Yeah. So whether this may achieve it needs a bit of publicity. So hopefully people will see this and understand that this is now going on offer on this NFT platform for people to see if they want to own it.
Will there be more than one photograph on the platform, or there'll be photograph?
Probably, I'll probably put a few up, yeah.
Okay, but there'll be one each of the various photographs?
Yeah, it has to be one each. So collectors can say, this is the original.
Original,
yeah. I retain copyright, but they collect these originals, and it seems very...
more like licensing.
Exciting for these collectors to do.
That's more like licensing then, right? I mean, if you retain the copyright in it and they're kind of have the exclusive license for it.
Well, I don't think it's a license. They just own it, but I keep the copyright.
My prediction, David, is it's going to be a foreign buyer. This story was all over the world. I mean, I couldn't believe the international coverage. And I'll bet somebody in, I don't know, Hong Kong or Bangalore, somebody's going to just pay up for this. I wish you the best on that.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that the photographic rights for the actual photograph itself could be very, very pricey. I'll keep my fingers crossed for you, but I think you'll get a good return on it.
Cool.
I really do.
Yeah.
Phenomenal photograph. I really do think you should share it with a monkey. Just get him in, take him out for coffee, sit down, you know, meet his family. You know, talk to the guy that hit you on the back when you're trying to come on to his wife and try and resolve that monkey business as best you can.
Yeah.
Now, what about your passion for it? Because I should say and credit you for being a wildlife photographer long before the monkey selfie case hits the papers. You've kind of dedicated somewhat your career to wildlife photography.
Well, I picked up a camera when I was 14 and when I was still at school and enjoyed taking outdoor photographs, mountains and those sort of things. And when I went to university, I sort of stopped that. Interest went elsewhere. But circumstances played their hand in order for me to become a wildlife photographer in that I had an academic career in university. So I was postdoc this and postdoc that, and I thought, and it has to do with volcanoes, and I thought that was going to be my career. But for various reasons, that all ended in a bit of a bad shadow, shall I say, because there were people getting in my way to promote my research. I would have been able to predict eruptions, I believe, at a very low cost, and it would have upset various universities who had a big getting a lot of the funds to predict eruptions. So I left and I became unemployed for a while whilst I wrote papers to try and promote the science. And in that time, my car was stolen and burnt out. I was at my wit's end. And I moved house. I teamed up with a girl from the university. She got a job. I followed her into the into Middle England, and from the insurance on this car, I couldn't even afford another car. They didn't pay me enough. But what I could afford was a camera. So I swapped my car for a camera at the end of all this academic problems, going on the benefits, moving house, buying a camera, and then I rediscovered my passion for the outdoors. So this was in about 1995.
What a great story. What a great beginning that, you know, basically swapped your car for the camera.
I took this camera out as I was unemployed, searching for work. And I just happened to go to a local woodland one day and take a prize-winning shot that won me a runner-up prize in the Wildlife Photographer of the Year contest, which is the biggest contest internationally that wildlife photographers know about. And I became a winner just off this one camera that I got from a disaster. And that got my name known, and agents came looking after me. And by 2000, I'd won several other prizes, photographic competitions, and I decided to go fully professional from 2000. So now I've been doing it 22 years with very little other income source coming in those times. So it's passion, and right? over that time, it's become more and more difficult to make any money from photography because all these online agents are popping up like Getty and Alamy, and there's Shutterstock, and the price for images have come rocketing down. At the same time, the digital revolution has gone upwards, and everybody has now a digital camera and big lenses. So making any living out of this sort of photography, that when I took this trip to Indonesia, I was quite worried that I'd make a loss on this one trip, because it's all gambling with your life and your income stream.
You can see why David signed a movie deal. I mean, I've got quite a colorful client here.
Well, your study in geology and volcanoes is interesting, because there's not a whole heck of a lot of money or positions in that particular choice either. And I know this because I have a daughter who, in fact, the PhD in volcanology, geology, and she's now an engineer, because you can't do much with a degree, even a PhD.
That's true.
Geology, when your focus is on volcanoes.
Yeah, and I became very disillusioned with it all as well, because the way I was pushed out of academia was mm-hmm. not nice. It was politically motivated and money motivated. I had problems talking to other researchers, because all the academia in around 1995 and so about, science became, as we now sort of understand, science became corrupted mm-hmm. with big money corporations, governments, and I got all embroiled in that, and I totally lost my love for science, because I just know how corrupted it could become.
I fully empathize, and I will simply tell you that I told my daughter to please let me sue on her behalf when she was ready to leave the program and say, I can't do this anymore, when her male companions were getting positions and she was not. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it goes on and on, but she just said, I'm getting out of academia. It's too political for me.
Yeah, I agree. I was a true scientist when I was a young lad. Absolutely believed in science. And now, mm-hmm. you know, we've had science all over for the last 2 years, and I don't trust any of it now. I know how it's corrupted. So that's all in my past now.
David, I have a T-shirt that says, I believe in science, and I wear that with pride.
Well, talk to me about your passion, though. Do you still have the passion to take, you know, are you involved in photography, the wildlife photography anymore? Do you still feel that draw, that passion?
Yeah. Well, after the court case, after 8 years battling this copyright issue, and I started to become worried that all my images would be stolen, and as well as other photographers, and as well with the decline in fees for photography, it was becoming quite stressful to think about my future. After this thing, it knocked me for six. I basically lost all my love for wildlife photography. I became quite sort of depressed, I'll admit. And it's taken a year, this last year, sitting at home, during lockdowns, getting very stressed and bored about life, I decided that I really need, for my own health and sanity, to get back out into the wilds. And I realised that that's what kept me going. It's not the photography so much, it's the just being outside, you know, communing with nature, understanding your place in the world, and this, that, and the other. And it's through animals that I discovered how to understand humans, hence the personality bit for my book. So I realised I really needed to connect back with nature, not so much with the photography, but it just seems to come natural to me that the photography helps me understand nature. It makes me focus on various things and see the beauty in everything. So it's like it is therapy for me. So now, in the last few months, I really started to go full tilt at getting my camera in my hands and getting out nearly every day like I used to do. And it's working. I feel a lot better just by having 3 months back out with my camera.
That's wonderful. Mm. Tell me, I have to ask this question. The moment that you take the camera back and you flip through and you see some of the photographs that truly appear to look like selfies that they were taking, what's that sensation inside?
It's hard to remember, it's so long ago now, but I have this impression that I wasn't too amazed by it for some reason. And I think Bradley said it earlier, photographers are used to setting up camera traps and for animals to take their own pictures. And so I wasn't really overly excited. I was more excited that it was an amazing photograph rather than the story behind it. For bizarre reasons. I don't know why I didn't think like this.
It was all in a day's work. This is what you were doing for a living. You were setting stuff up, you were doing the mechanics, you were, you know, and you were working with the environment as best you could, and obviously successfully, to get the photograph, you know.
There's two sides to it all. One is the sort of the instinctive, intuitive, creative side, and the communing with nature bit. But then when you get into the camera technology and the aspects and the setting the lenses, and that becomes like an ego side. It's more materialistic, and I find it very hard to get into the materialistic side of photography. I hate talking about cameras. I don't like talking to other photographers. I'd rather talk to them about wildlife and what it means to them. So when I was there, for some reason the technical aspect, the ego, took over, and it was just a good photograph. It was only later that, when my agent contacted me to ask about these series of images, did he realize what an amazing story it was.
It is an amazing story.
I was blind to it all.
Well, it is an amazing story, David. I mean, we're going to be following. Judge and I were talking about the fact that when the movie comes out, we're going to watch it together.
I'm in. And I just went to Amazon. I could not locate your book. So I would like your email so that I can get from you either a book or a photograph or something, or a contact so that I can get it. And I will put it up in my office and my house.
I think the website. We're going to put up links to your website. To be able to, you know, buy your book to get to your website. That's the main, I think that's the best place to get information.
Through my website, and you can buy the prints through the website too.
And also, Andrew will put up a link to anyone who wants to check out your firm. certainly you masterminded, as I said earlier, a brilliant legal argument. You did a really good job with it. So we give kudos to you.
No, I've got to say to Andrew that I couldn't have asked for better. Out of the 12 people that interviewed me, Andrew stood out a mile, and he was brilliant. He kept me sane throughout. He clearly knows his business extremely well. And if ever I get into this position again, I'll be straight on the phone to you, Andrew.
I hope whoever you looked at and retained for your movie rights does as good a job for you as Andrew has.
He's done a brilliant job.
Thank you, Andrew.
Well, I want to thank you both, Well, Judge, of course, thank you for co-hosting with me today.
Thank you for letting me be here. It's been absolutely fascinating.
And I want to thank Andrew for you coming on and giving us your insight into the legal aspects of the case. I want to thank David for telling us the story. It is a very compelling story. And I'll put all the links in the video below. I do look forward to watching the movie. I hope they capture the essence of who you are as a person, which is a passionate, creative soul.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, folks.
And on that note, I'm going to say goodbye to everybody. Thank you for joining us today.